Hello, welcome to this LLC Ideas special book launch as part of the China Foresight Program at the London School of Economics Ideas. Today we'll be talking about Chinese diplomacy from peaceful rise to wolf warrior, talking about Peter Martin's new book, see if I can get you to see it here, which I've read and found very helpful and interesting. Peter Martin is a journalist. He's lived in China for over 8 years, or has lived in China for over 8 years. Now he's in Washington, D.C. as a defense and international relations reporter for Bloomberg. Since we're at the London School of Economics, we should note that Peter is an alumni of the LSE Peking University Joint MSc in International Affairs. So it's great to see you go on and do wonderful things. He reports on US national security from the Pentagon and the State Department. He's gonna speak for about 20 minutes, and then my colleague, Professor Astrid Norden, will comment on it. Professor Norden is the Lau Chair of Chinese International Relations at King's College London, just across the streets from the LSE. And she's very well known for her expertise on Chinese, kind of the broadest, a broad view of China's international politics. Right now, she's looking at anger and emotions in Chinese international relations. My name is William A. Callahan. I'm a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. My interest is in the global politics of China. And with no further ado, Peter, please tell us about your book.
Yeah, thanks. So thanks so much for hosting me. And it's especially, a sort of happy moment for me to be speaking at the LSE, even if it's over the distance of an ocean and a little bit all the way from Washington. I thought I'd talk a little bit about why I came to write a book on a topic as arcane as Chinese diplomats and how, you know, some of the arguments and findings of the book and how perhaps in kind of an unexpected way it's ended up being a much more mainstream topic than I thought at the outset. So I guess it kind of stems back to arriving in China in early 2017. I've been away for a few years, living in India and then in Washington, and it couldn't help but be struck by, of course, the huge strides that China was making in terms of its hard power. Its economy was beating analysts' estimates. Xi Jinping was rolling out the Belt and Road Initiative across the world. The Chinese military was busy, militarizing artificial islands in the South China Sea, setting up China's first overseas base for the military in Djibouti in Africa. And perhaps most importantly of all, there was this incredible opportunity which seemed to present itself to Beijing in the shape of the Trump administration. President Trump was busy picking fights with US allies, scorning international organizations, and there seemed to be this moment where China had an opportunity to step up and take a greater global leadership role. But I guess what became apparent to me watching this play out from foreign ministry briefings in Beijing, speaking to foreign diplomats in China, and just kind of watching the global reaction was that, in fact, even as this opportunity shaped up, China was really struggling to take advantage of it. While its hard power kind of went from strength to strength, that ability to persuade others to perform the art of diplomacy to win hearts and minds was really lagging. And when you step back and you think about the kind of world that we're moving into as we confront a kind of global situation where there are multiple competing centers of power, that ability to persuade is going to command a real premium. And any country which is able to master it will be at a great advantage. And I guess I came to see Chinese diplomats as kind of a microcosm of that broader struggle that China has to communicate with the world. And they came to sort of fascinate me, even on a kind of personal level, because this is a group of people who need to be simultaneously fluent in two completely different worlds at the same time. They need to be fluent in the world of you know, the kind of closed world of Chinese Communist Party politics, and able to interpret signs and signals that are going on inside that system. They also need to be fluent in the kind of much more rarefied world of international diplomacy, and kind of maintain one foot in each. And you can see it on a personal level when you interact with them. You know, as individuals, they often come across as pretty suave, funny, sophisticated. There are graduates of Georgetown University, graduates of the LSE. They speak multiple foreign languages. But when you sit down with them, you watch them in person, you know, when they sit down in meetings with foreign counterparts, or they get up on the podium in the foreign ministry to speak in public, they often come across as kind of stilted, rigid, ideological, and in recent years, of course, increasingly aggressive and hostile. And so I started to kind of try to figure out the roots of this behavior, and really used as my source base, you know, interviews that I was doing in Beijing and across the world with people who had spent their lives interacting with Chinese diplomats, but really primarily this group of about 100 memoirs by former Chinese envoys, most of which hadn't really been used in English language research before. And they're pretty tedious books, and you kind of have to go through them patiently and tease out little details, but kind of taken together, they paint a picture of what it's like to be on the front lines of Chinese diplomacy and foreign policy. And that really was the kind of starting point for the book. And when I started out, honestly, it was a pretty niche topic, something that I thought might be interesting to kind of foreign policy types in Washington and perhaps beyond. But, you know, of course, since I began in 2017, we've had Chinese diplomats shouting at foreign counterparts, storming out of international meetings, spreading conspiracy theories about the origins of COVID-19. And it's really become a much, much more mainstream topic. But I guess that the thing that jumped out to me above all as I was doing all of this research was that while many aspects of the wolf warrior phenomenon are new, there's actually a great deal of continuity as well. And indeed, much of that continuity dates all the way back to the kind of founding moment of the PRC in 1949. So when Mao Zedong established the People's Republic, China basically had no diplomats to speak of. The communist government had kicked out any of the nationalist governments who had stayed behind in Beijing and Nanjing, because it believed they were too ideologically impure to represent the new regime. And they faced kind of a paradoxical challenge. You know, on the one hand, this was a highly paranoid, secretive political party, which was deeply troubled by any external threat to its power and legitimacy. And on the other hand, it needed to win friends outside of the Soviet bloc and to establish itself as the legitimate government of China. And so to square this circle, Zhou Enlai, who was the PRC's first foreign minister and really, I think, the founding father of modern PRC diplomacy, he came up with this idea that Chinese diplomats should think and act like the People's Liberation Army in civilian clothing. And what he meant by that was that they should be unfailingly loyal to the Communist Party, that they should be disciplined to a fault, and that they should display what he called a fighting spirit whenever China's interests were challenged. And so with that kind of militaristic ethos came a bunch of really distinctive behaviors, which were visible in 1949, and many of which have lasted all the way through till today. So Chinese diplomats will typically stick extremely closely to talking points, even when those talking points don't resonate with foreign audiences. They will move around in pairs to keep tabs on each other using a system they call two people walking together, 二人同行. they will shout at foreign counterparts when they feel cornered or they worry about not looking tough enough back home. And they'll sometimes elevate even the smallest of perceived slights or insults into major international incidents if they worry that failing to do so might make them look disloyal. And so this kind of approach led to displays of what we might now call wolf warrior diplomacy right from the outset. In 1950, this veteran revolutionary leader called Wu Xiuquan, guy had a kind of a bullet scar across his cheek. He led a delegation to the United Nations in New York, and he delivered a speech which honestly makes today's wolf warriors look like a bunch of wimps. Time magazine described it as two awful hours of rasping vituperation, which gives you some idea of the tone that he managed to set in the room. And of course, in the 1960s, Chinese diplomats were expelled from countries ranging from Kenya to Indonesia for their provocative behavior. They handed out copies of Mao Zedong's little red book on the streets of foreign capitals. And in London, outside of the Chinese representative office, Chinese diplomats were, you know, literally engaged in a fist fight with protesters, and one of them was pictured wielding an axe as he stood up to protesters. So I think that that kind of wolf warrior type behavior goes back a very, very long way. But at the same time, it's important to kind of keep it in the context of another tradition that exists in Chinese diplomacy, which is this need to win friends and to build influence. And at other times in the PRC's history, its diplomatic corps has been capable of taking that extraordinary discipline that Zhou Enlai required of it and turning it toward winning friends and building influence. So in the 1950s, China's diplomatic corps focused on expanding China's circle of friends outside of the Soviet bloc, an effort which was kind of epitomized by Zhou Enlai's appearance at the 1955 Bandung Conference for Asian and African Nations. In the 1990s, when China was very much a pariah state in the aftermath of the 1989 Tiananmen massacre, Chinese diplomats kind of spearheaded a nearly two-decade charm offensive, which helped to rehabilitate the country's image and, of course, culminated ultimately in China hosting the 2008 Summer Olympic Games. So I kind of think of there being two tendencies in Chinese diplomacy which cycle in and out over time. There is a tendency toward charming the world, and there's a tendency toward using wolf warrior tactics to tell the world off. And I think that recently we've seen a pretty decisive lurch back toward that kind of combative assertiveness that that was on display in the early 50s and parts of the 60s. And I think that's the result of two things. I think on the one hand, there's a new confidence on the part of Chinese elites. And on the other hand, there are these kind of enduring insecurities, which have their roots in China's political system and have been exacerbated by the policies of President Xi Jinping. So the new confidence really started, I think, around 2008-09, in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, when we saw a couple of years of really quite assertive Chinese diplomacy on the country's borders, as Chinese elites kind of reassessed the global landscape and started to think that perhaps the degree of deference that they had shown the West in the past was no longer needed. But that shift toward increasing assertiveness became increasingly apparent after Xi Jinping became Communist Party boss in 2012. And under Xi, China's political system has become an increasingly tense and even oftentimes scary place. So President Xi has spearheaded an anti-corruption campaign, which has punished more than 1.5 million officials. He has experimented with the use of re-education camps in far western China. He has abolished presidential term limits, potentially setting himself up as leader for life. And his speeches have focused on ideology at home and have often displayed quite a striking degree of hostility toward foreign cultural and especially political influences in Chinese politics. And so when Chinese diplomats see these signals, they know exactly how to interpret them. You know, over the years, the foreign ministry itself has experienced multiple rounds of purges in which colleagues were encouraged to inform on each other. During the Cultural Revolution, Chinese ambassadors were locked in cellars, forced to clean toilets. Some of them were beaten until they coughed up blood. And large numbers of Chinese diplomats themselves were sent off to re-education camps in the countryside. And so they know exactly how high the stakes can be when you get on the wrong side of the Chinese political system and a potentially self-aggrandizing Chinese political leader. And so I think the result, the outcome was that a lot of Chinese diplomats began to mimic what was a much more assertive and ambitious tone from Xi Jinping in their own diplomacy. They heard President Xi speaking about China moving closer to the center of the world stage, never putting up with bullying from foreign powers, standing tall in the East. And they started to incorporate that into the way that they address the world. And if they were ambitious, perhaps they added a little bit of extra kind of nationalism just for good measure. And this tone really went into high gear after the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. China was under attack for its role in covering up the origins of the virus, but it also felt like its model had once again been validated by the West's inability to contain the spread. And it resulted, I think, in a series of outbursts, apparently cheered on by President Xi, who during the outbreak of the pandemic even issued a handwritten note to the Chinese foreign ministry calling for more fighting spirit on the part of its diplomats. And, you know, given the changes that President Xi has enacted domestically in China, I think if any of us were on the receiving end of that note, we would pretty quickly fall into line. And I guess if the change in Chinese diplomacy has been typified by one person, that person would be Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian, who has kind of become the face of wolf warrior diplomacy. Zhao was a relatively obscure figure posted to the Chinese embassy in Islamabad, who built up quite a substantial Twitter following and used that following to engage in a series of public spats, most notably with former US National Security Advisor Susan Rice, which kind of rocketed him to domestic stardom in China. When he returned to Beijing after his Islamabad posting, he was literally greeted by a group of young Chinese diplomats who applauded him as he approached his office. And he has used his new post as foreign ministry spokesman to anger pretty much anyone who's come across his path. But probably most notably, he angered the Australian government when he posted an illustration of an Australian soldier holding a knife to the throat of an Afghan child. And he sent shockwaves through the Trump administration when he suggested that the US Army had deliberately started the coronavirus pandemic. And, you know, Zhao is actually just one of a whole cast of characters who have been behaving in this kind of provocative way. Gui Tongyo, who until recently was China's ambassador in Sweden, was summoned to the country's foreign ministry 40 times in the space of 2 years for his behavior. And when he was asked about it in a media interview, he said, "For our friends, we have fine wine, and for our enemies, we have shotguns." But not everyone, I guess, is as comfortable as Zhao and Gui with this new approach. Yuan Nansheng, who was China's former consul general in San Francisco, has warned about a trend toward extreme nationalism in Chinese foreign policy, which is alienating others. And most recently, in December, China's former ambassador to the US, Cui Tiankai, warned that in the face of complex situations, Chinese officials should keep the interests of the country at large in mind and not think about becoming internet celebrities. And I think it's not difficult to guess who his remarks there might be aimed at. But I guess that, you know, as long as Xi Jinping maintains the kind of focus that he has on a more bold and assertive China, which is unapologetic about the way it pursues its interests, then I think we can expect Wolf Warrior diplomacy to continue alongside it, even if the tactics change and shift over time. And we can get into that later. Maybe there I'll just kind of pause my remarks and we can get into a discussion. Thank you so much for listening.
Hey, thank you, Peter, for that description. And Professor Norden, please give us your comments.
Thank you. Thanks again, Peter. So for full disclosure, this is kind of the sequel to a conversation that Peter and I started at KCL before Christmas, where we also discussed his book. And I've been thinking a bit about it since then.
Wolf Warrior 2.
Yes, particularly around this kind of theme of anger that I'm very interested in your work. And I think seeing some of the comments that we're getting from the audience, there are a lot of questions about assertiveness and whether this is something new. And what I got from your book was not the suggestion that assertiveness was either particular to China or logically difficult to understand, but that there was a kind of a aggression in the style of diplomatic communication that is particular and on the rise, that harks back to previous eras as well. And as I kind of reread my own comments from before Christmas and your book, I wondered a lot about the gendered nature of this aggression, because we talk a lot about, you know, the militaristic ethos of this diplomatic style. And we talk a lot about toxic masculinity. This was a very common trope discussed around Trump's aggressive Twitter diplomacy, and perhaps with Twitter as a kind of seedbed for a toxic masculinity on the rise. And I think that this, if there is such a toxic masculinity that can be seen in this Wolf Warrior diplomacy, it's very nicely kind of seen in your book how the source of this sits in an oscillation or combination of confidence and insecurity, which I think also resonates really nicely actually with a lot of Bill's excellent work about pessimism and optimism in oscillation. So I thought that was really, really neat as an explanatory kind of focus. So I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the kind of the gendered nature of this. And also it made me wonder, are there any women wolf warriors? Of course, Chinese diplomacy, like the rest of Chinese politics, is hyper-masculine, right? But do you know of any examples of Chinese female diplomats behaving in this way on Twitter or elsewhere? And I was also wondering a little bit about the kind of global viability of this toxic masculinity as a form of subjectivity, perhaps, or a form of communication, because you talk about the global reaction to this diplomacy as kind of a sign that the diplomacy isn't working. But we've seen kind of polls recently about lacking or declining trust in China in many countries of the world, but also actually a rising trust in a lot of countries. And I think these countries are diverse. We've seen it in places like Mexico and South Africa, Brazil, Nigeria, Argentina. All these countries are ones where in recent years we've seen an increased kind of popularity, confidence, trust in China and Chinese actors. So my curiosity is partly about, well, is it just that in those places where China seems more popular in this era, is it just that people don't care so much about what someone says on Twitter because money matters more, for example? Or is it that some are attracted to this toxic kind of rhetoric, this wolf warrior rhetoric, toxic masculinity, call it what you will, also outside of China? We've seen the purchase it's had in American politics, right, with certain audiences there. So might it be that there are, in fact, international audiences, whether in diplomatic circles or in, elsewhere in the population, who are, in fact, attracted to this kind of bullying, one-upmanship, toxic masculinity that's on display in this type of rhetoric? That was one of my curiosities. I'll let you respond to that before we talk about other things.
Yeah, I love those questions. The gendered aspect of wolf warrior diplomacy is something that I'll have to kind of chew on and explore a little bit more. Well, I mean, one thing that kind of immediately sprung to mind was that, you know, Zhou Enlai, who I associate really with, when he was left to his own devices, at least, who I associate more with that kind of like charm offensive, winning and friends, building influence type model of Chinese diplomacy, was people sort of constantly talked about how he had a slightly kind of feminine nature throughout his life, a sort of motherliness to him. And I don't know how that that translates into diplomacy, to be truthful, but it kind of is one thing that kind of sprung to mind for me. I think in general, the tone of the Xi administration fits with this sort of macho politics that we've seen from people like Vladimir Putin, to some extent Donald Trump, and it expresses itself in a very different way in China, in honestly in a much more kind of ordered way, which is filtered through the kind of you know, repetitive Marxese type style that the Chinese government uses to communicate. But I nevertheless think it's there. And there are certainly some, you know, Xi Jinping was famously quoted saying that the Soviet Union fell because none of the Soviet leaders were man enough to hold it together. And so I do think there is this kind of premium that he sets on masculinity and manliness, which probably filters through the system. In terms of female practitioners, I mean, I think the leading candidate would be Hua Chunying, who is the chief spokesperson at the foreign ministry. And I watched her kind of evolve during my time in Beijing when I would go to foreign ministry press briefings in 2017. Of the three spokespeople at the time, Deng Shuang, Liu Kang, and Hua Chunying, Hua was by far the least likely to make news because she stuck so studiously to the kind of to the script and really wasn't inflammatory in the way she expressed herself at all. But I, you know, over time, she transformed really quite dramatically over the course of the Trump administration, and spoke by the time I left Beijing in a way that was just kind of indistinguishable from like a Global Times editorial. It was really, really combative stuff. And you know, my understanding would be that she's pretty comfortable with that tone. This is not something that's been thrust upon her, but she feels empowered to kind of speak in that way, given the way that circumstances have changed in China. So she I would identify as kind of a leading practitioner of that approach. There are other people who have used, other females who have used wolf warrior tactics in the past, even if we might not identify them as kind of archetypal wolf warriors. So, you know, Fu Ying comes to mind, former Chinese vice minister, very prominent figure in China's kind of public diplomacy efforts to this day. She has, you know, is very capable of charming people. She's exceptionally talented when it comes to kind of stroking the egos of old white men hungry for influence in retirement. But she also, when she needs to, can really turn up the heated rhetoric. And so I kind of think of her maybe not as a leading wolf warrior, but certainly someone who's able to use that skill set to great effect. So those are kind of the thoughts that come to mind on that first question. In terms of the viability, it has landed differently in different places. I think the impact of wolf warrior diplomacy has been most negative across OECD countries, across the West. And you can see that through, you referenced opinion polling, Pew's data on this is really very, very striking. Taken together with China's foreign policy writ large, I think wolf warrior diplomacy has really had a negative impact there. There are parts of the developing world where it's also been really negative. There are a billion Indian people who have been pretty upset by China's foreign policy, China's militarism on the border with India, but also, some of the incredibly provocative statements that came out of the Chinese consulate in Kolkata, for example, on Twitter. In places like Africa, China, I don't think, has pushed as hard on its wolf warrior messaging. Most of the examples of wolf warrior diplomacy we've seen there tended to actually focus on the US rather than aiming to kind of pressure local elites. So I think China's tactics have changed a little bit. And as you said, the priorities of the audiences are also very different. It's not like leaders in any of these countries are blind to the way that China's communication style has shifted. But I think it's probably fair to say that the degree to which they prioritize Chinese infrastructure spending or investment, for example, might be higher. And that accounts for some of the difference in response. And just finally on your point about whether some people are attracted by it, I think, painting broad brushstrokes, the answer is no, with the possible exception of populists, which I don't really see necessarily as a developing country phenomenon or a developed country phenomenon. It's more, it kind of cuts across. And I do think that there is a strand of global populism which is incredibly hostile toward US leadership, where, typified by people like Viktor Orban in Hungary and to some extent Putin and others, where there is probably some resonance for the way that and some similarity between the way that they talk about global politics and the way that wolf warriors talk about US leadership. And I feel like my answer has gone on long enough, but those are such stimulating questions. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, I remember when Fu Ying was ambassador to the UK, and she was very charming, as you say, but then there was some controversy, I forget what it was, and she just told all British people that we were stupid and just you're idiots. You don't even know your own history, kind of things, like, whoa. So we have a couple questions from the floor. One is, what would be your advice to Western foreign policymakers in dealing with Chinese diplomats? Is there anything they can do to kind of deal with the wolf warrior diplomacy?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a few things. One, remember that China has diplomatic objectives which extend beyond the theatrics, and that Chinese diplomats themselves are people who, after all, have dedicated their lives to telling China's story and to winning friends. There are people who join militaries because they believe that military force is effective, and people who join foreign ministries tend to believe in diplomacy, and that's true of China, just as it's true of other countries, even if the political systems are different. So I would say, look for those moments on the sidelines of meetings when there might be a chance for a kind of frank exchange or a personal touch, which isn't possible on, when Chinese diplomats are kind of gesticulating and posturing in front of their delegation. So this is harder in the age of COVID when there are far fewer in-person interactions, but I think it's something that's kind of worth thinking about and bearing in mind. And kind of on that note, be very attentive to the body language and signals that are sent after meetings. You know, I talked to lots of lots of foreign diplomats who have sat through these kind of shouting sessions in the foreign ministry in Beijing. And once the dressing down is over, the Chinese interlocutor who led that dressing down will kind of put their arm on the back of the person they were talking to and walk them out to the parking lot and say how nice it was to see them. And I think that there is there's some kind of messaging in that body language too. So keep that stuff in mind. And then I guess just on a practical note, something that I've really seen evolve even in the last year is just changing the format of meetings with the Chinese side. You know, if you think back to the US-China meetings in Anchorage, I think it was in March 2021, where Yang Jiechi launched into this kind of 17-minute diatribe aimed at the US side. I think, you know, since then, the US in its bilateral meetings with China has tended not to include opening remarks as a fixture. And that's, you know, that's worked out pretty well, I think, for everyone involved. So, yeah, those two notes kind of come to mind.
One of the things that I think about and my students say, oh, don't pay attention to these things, it's all just for a domestic audience. And therefore, it doesn't matter. My sense is that might have been convincing in the 1990s, but it's not really convincing now. And it's not like one country can tell people to not listen to what they're saying. I mean, I'm starting to babble, but do you find that argument persuasive? Because to me, it's more like, whoa, they're saying these things in English even, so why don't we take them? Why shouldn't we take them seriously?
Well, I mean, I agree with that, but in addition to that, the most important domestic audience for those comments is Xi Jinping. And if that's the tone that he expects from Chinese diplomats, then that's an important signal to us that we need to take seriously about his attitude toward international politics. So, they don't want to look weak in front of him. They want to project an image of China, which they think is, in keeping with President Xi's vision for what the country should look and sound like. And that matters.
Okay. I'll take a question for myself. Have you had a beer with Zhao Lijian? Does he hang out with people? And if so, is he different? Because you were suggesting sometimes it's a performance and it's a different performance when they are not on camera.
I have never had a beer with Zhao Lijian. I would say that in person, he is, and you can see this actually if you just watch videos of Chinese foreign ministry briefings, quite soft-spoken. He kind of stammers a little bit, just, you know, he's not, someone like Deng Shuang, who is now at the UN, but was previously one of the spokespeople, he can just speak in paragraphs. The guy oozes charm and confidence. And Zhao is very different to that. And I think it's a reflection of the fact that Zhao wasn't part of the public affairs, public diplomacy apparatus of the foreign ministry until he got this job. He's not someone who was trained up for this position. He's someone who was given it because, he acted in a way that was seen to be appropriate in Xi Jinping's China and was rewarded for it. Not my words, but it's been suggested to me that, you know, you can kind of think of him as a little bit like an internet troll, in the sense that he's someone who is quite unassuming in person, but has this massive online personality. And I wouldn't want to go so far as to endorse that comment directly, but it's something people have said to me. Others, I mean, the contrast is really striking. These are like I said at the opening, these are like funny, sophisticated people who you can, when they're able to let their guard down a little bit, you can really have a good conversation with them, and you get a strong sense of their personality, and then they just transform on stage. It's really quite extraordinary. And you know, I guess the very strongest example of that is Yang Jiechi, who has been a fixture now of Chinese diplomacy for many decades, and just has this extraordinary degree of self-control. The guy is kind of light and joking and referencing reviews he read in the New York Times culture section. And then, you know, I've had former Bush administration officials tell me they just wanted to run out of the room when he went on one of his rants. And so there, and I kind of think that's an important thing to remember too, that these are performances, they're acts of self-control and will. This is not people losing it or getting angry in a way where they are out of control.
We should remind everyone that Yang Jiechi is a graduate of the International Relations Department at the LSE. He came as part of the first group of students in 1973, and he was like, he came from the fields. It was just amazing, that group of a dozen students who came in 73. So that's what I tell everybody. If you want to be the Chinese foreign minister, come to the LSE IR department. Another question is not about your book, but it's about kind of Chinese foreign policy more generally. And the person asks, will China and Russia become true allies? And if so, what are the core factors that may solidify a potential alliance? I mean, of course, China doesn't use the word alliance. It says alliance is bad because it's always directed against a third party. Talks in terms of partnerships, but will China and Russia become ally-like partners?
It's an important question. And it's something that I've really noticed even in the last 6 months has kind of picked up as a topic of conversation in DC, where some people think that it might be possible for the US to pull off a kind of a Kissinger and Nixon moment and kind of separate Beijing and Moscow. And other people think that we're heading for a full-fledged alliance. I tend to think the truth probably lies somewhere in between those two. In the long term, I do think you can make a compelling case that Russian elites may eventually find a very powerful, very militarized country on their border threatening, and that there could be some sort of longer term divergence between the two countries. But honestly, I think that might not become a reality, if ever, for a generation. You know, it's almost like an irrelevance at this point. I think as long as both Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are in power, we can expect to see this kind of convergence of interests continue. I think from Beijing's perspective, Russia provides great cover. You know, I was on Secretary Blinken's trip recently to Ukraine, Berlin, and to Geneva, and was struck by just the sheer amount of senior US government time that Putin has managed to suck up now. And I think that's pretty great from Beijing's perspective. You know, a distracted United States which isn't able to compete with China. And you know, I think that Beijing, in a slightly more low-key way, also provides Putin with some pretty useful cover. You know, Wang Yi, for example, speaking recently about Russia's legitimate security concerns in Eastern Europe, provides them with interesting cover. And you can kind of see that, you know, it's much deeper than just rhetoric. I think one of the most telling indicators in recent years was that for a long time, Russia kind of refrained from selling China its most advanced military equipment for fear of arming a potential competitor on its borders, and has recently kind of gone all in on selling Beijing pretty much whatever it wants, including some very dangerous equipment. And that's a sign, I think, of kind of a deeper strategic alignment that's there. And, you know, friends and enemies are not permanent in international politics. Maybe things will change. I think it's certainly easy to make a good intuitive case of why they might. I'm just not sure that I see that in the tea leaves at the moment.
Astrid, do you have a question you want to ask?
Thank you. So hearing you speak and thinking more about this kind of masculinization, militarization of a lot of this diplomatic rhetoric, I was wondering if you are able to comment at all on kind of parallels in Chinese theorizations of China's international relations. So I am quite interested in a lot of domestic Chinese theorizations of international relations and the claim that China should develop a kind of a Chinese school or a Chinese approach to international relations, and that the kind of the theories that are put forward and the people who put them forward are, it's a very masculine and hand-centric sphere, right? So there are a lot of exclusions going on there, both of ethnic minorities who are marginalized from what's said to be a kind of confusion at Han China that has something to contribute to the world, but it's also an extremely kind of male zone. Now, the masculinity at the center of a lot of these theorizations is not the kind of toxic masculinity that we've looked at in this wolf warrior phenomenon, but I think tries to resonate more with ideals of a kind of Confucian scholar type masculinity. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts at all about how the kind of theorizations in scholarship, particularly within this Chinese school, might resonate, contradict, support, or otherwise relate to this kind of divided diplomatic approach in China, where you've got on the one hand a kind of more focus on patience, on a kind of motherliness that you describe, and on the other hand this kind of very aggressive militarized masculinity.
Something that people used to say about the Trump administration's China policy was that they didn't so much have a strategy as an attitude. And so I guess if I were to kind of hijack that formulation and apply it to wolf warrior diplomats, I guess I don't think they have so much a theory as an attitude. I find it quite, I mean, it's a fascinating question, but I find it, you know, thinking over the rhetoric, quite difficult to tease out what exactly the theoretical perspective would be. There is, I guess, this kind of slightly like left of center intellectual critique of US foreign policy, which is kind of implicit in some of the ways that they talk about the United States and its alliances. And I guess when you ask them questions about the backlash against China, they'll say things like, oh, this is, you know, other countries are just criticizing China because the US has told them to and it's in charge. And there's kind of, I don't know, the 1970s like Marxist writing on foreign policy that's sort of like tucked in there, but I don't know that it's that serious on a kind of theoretical level. And the other insight, which kind of you know, consistently emerges, or the other sort of thought that consistently emerges, is this idea that China is peaceful. And that I find really amusing to kind of watch play out in person. I used to go to the defense ministry's briefings in Beijing. They happened once a month. And I remember China was getting ready to hold a massive military parade on the streets of Beijing. A reporter asked, you know, does this fit with China's peaceful rise image? And, you know, spokesman, I mean, he didn't exactly say this, but his reply was like, why don't you come over here and tell me we're not peaceful? You know, it was really kind of like aggressively insisting that China's intentions were good. So those are the two kind of things that come to mind in terms of Wolf Warrior's like image of the world and theoretical perspective. It's like a critique of the US and its alliance system, and then this assumption China's intentions are always and have always been good, and, you know, my God, you'll get in trouble if you suggest otherwise.
Yeah, I guess to follow up on that, is there a sense in China that telling countries, whether it's the Philippines or India or whatever, that when they do something that China doesn't like, that they're just pawns of the US, that is not really an effective way of kind of building relations? Because it's happens every day, and it's amazing to me that nobody has told them that this is not really a good strategy. Maybe that's not their objective. My other question, we're running out of time, so I wanted to slip this in. It's just a little teeny question. Will China invade Taiwan?
So on the first point, I think that I'm really fascinated by how far they believe that line, that countries that criticize China are just pawns for the US. And I think the answer is that they probably kind of half believe it. They legitimately make the point that the world is bigger than the West, and that the US alliance system as a proportion of global GDP is shrinking, and these kind of things. And so they kind of have like a reasonable, at least partial rebuttal on that point. I think they hold sincerely, and would be happy to, you know, they're kind of comfortable and happy making that case. I think there's also an extent to which that is the most politically convenient thing for them to say and believe. Maybe they half believe it, but they say it very, very enthusiastically. It's not a good time in China to suggest that the country's foreign policies have created a massive backlash, and that the direction that Xi Jinping has taken Chinese statecraft has been counterproductive. No one wants to write that cable back from an overseas embassy to Beijing, and no one wants to speak that truth to power in Zhongnanhai. And so I do think that there is an element of kind of political convenience in that response as well. On the tiny question of whether China will invade Taiwan, I don't know. And I don't think that, I wrote a piece a couple of months ago about how the CIA is having trouble discerning the intentions of Xi Jinping and his inner circle on the Taiwan question and a variety of other issues, and that the access to his inner circle is just really incredibly limited. China has gotten very good at counterintelligence, and Xi Jinping's inner circle is small. He doesn't practice collective leadership, so you're focused on a really small group of individuals. And the reason I say that, and the reason I think that matters, is that anyone in Washington and beyond can come up with a very compelling sort of inductive case about why invading Taiwan would be crazy. Amphibious landings are extraordinarily difficult. That's why the Allies waited until 1944 to invade Normandy. You know, they remain difficult today. China couldn't necessarily prevail, especially if the US and Japan and other countries were to intervene. Establishing a beachhead is the easy part, maintaining it is the difficult part. All of China's anti-access capabilities become useless the second that they land troops, and they're the ones who have to defend against US and Taiwanese defensive measures. That case is like plain and out there. The problem is we have no idea whether that case resonates with Xi Jinping. And we could also come up with a good, you know, I remember before term limits were abolished, people, including me, kind of thought, well, I think it's unlikely that Xi Jinping will abolish term limits because he doesn't need to, because he can just run China from behind the scenes once he steps down. And why would he bother going through that formal step? But he's a risk tolerant politician, and he did it anyway. You know, you could make a good case when he promised President Obama on the South Lawn of the White House in 2015 that he wouldn't militarize the South China Sea, that, well, you know, China does rely a lot on trade with the US, and they need to cooperate in certain areas, so he'll probably keep that promise. He did it anyway. And so I think that's kind of the crux of the problem with Taiwan. Like, on one level, it makes absolutely no sense, and on the other level, we have absolutely no idea if Xi Jinping agrees with that.
Okay, we have 3 minutes left. Astrid, do you have any other questions or comments?
No, maybe I'll just thank Peter and you, Bill, for a really interesting conversation. You give me so much food for thought through. I'll certainly go and think more about kind of the gendered nature of anger in Chinese diplomatic rhetoric, and also perhaps the way that it's racialized and xenophobic in many ways, and how that sits in a broader global climate where these types of speech are perhaps on the rise. So that's something I'm going to go and think a lot more about, and you've given me, you've got a lot of good leads for where to
me
go
too.
And dig. So thank you very much for that.
Okay, well, I will thank Peter Martin for talking to us about his book, and thank Professor Astrid Norden for her comments, and thank the LSE Ideas team, including Lucas Fiala. And well, just keep your eye out for other LSE Ideas seminars. So have a nice day.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.